Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When jazz legend Oscar Peterson sat down at the piano and played Basin Street Blues, he said he could feel the love of the instrument flowing through every phrase and run. Those 88 black and white keys came as a portal to a new world, with its own history, its own sense of beauty, its own sound. The piano came with a long line of composers, performers, and innovators who would change the world with the piano keys at their fingertips. This hour on Point, Piano, the Untold Story. You can join the conversation. What's your history with the piano? What do you hear behind its rumble, its keystrokes? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And joining me now is in from New York is Stuart Isikoff. He's a pianist and composer. He's a professor of music at Purchase College at the State University of New York, and he's the founding editor of Piano Today and the author of the new book out this month called A Natural History of the Piano, The Instrument, the Music, the Musicians, from Mozart to modern jazz and everything in between. Stuart Isikoff, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much, Jackie. It's a thrill to be here.
Well, what an undertaking. Now, I know that you are a pianist and teach piano and have written before about the piano and, of course, established the magazine Piano Today. But why take on the life of the piano and choose this instrument over, say, the guitar or the flute or the drum or anything else?
Well, I guess the simplest explanation is that I've played the piano since I was 7 years old. I love it every bit as much today as I did back when I was a child. And it's been an instrument that has transformed the world in so many ways. I thought that it would be interesting to explore the various layers of its history and the way it influenced music and musicians over hundreds of years.
We've been listening to Oscar Peterson, and you begin your book with him. And you were at one of his, I guess, the last performance he did at Birdland in New York. Was he one of the greats you were listening to while you were growing up playing piano?
The very first jazz album I ever owned was an Oscar Peterson album of his performance in 1958 at the Newport Jazz Festival with a trio. And I probably wore the plastic of that vinyl album out eventually because of the number of times I listened to it. So he always thrilled me, as he thrilled so many music lovers. And I opened with him, really, first of all, to tell readers that the book is going to have a modern sensibility, but also because he represents a truly great artist who had classical training and who merged these various strands of piano history together in his own art.
Aside from this this passion for Peterson and your personal history, does the piano hold a certain status in music history?
Well, in Victorian England, it surely did. And that was the period and the place in which the piano really proliferated, blossomed and mushroomed to the point that George Bernard Shaw described it as a religion. And in those days, having a piano had enormous social status connected with it. People in the middle class who had aspirations for moving up the social ladder had to have an instrument. Many of them were works of art with paintings on them and pithy mottos and so on. And young ladies were expected to study the piano if they wanted to snare a good husband, for example. This was all part of the training for a high quality of life. And in that sense, the piano was essential in nearly every household.
Later on, of course, as you write in this book, it transcends class and genre, and you do find it, you say quite frankly, in bordellos. Why? Why did it become so widespread, so portable?
Well, the piano has so many advantages as an instrument. The range is as wide as an orchestra's. And with just 10 fingers, one can render all kinds of different music on it. It's just so flexible in the kinds of expressive sounds, the kinds of styles that it can offer. People brought pianos into their homes partly so that before the era of radio and CDs and so on, that they could have great music right in their living rooms. And people like Liszt would write piano versions of Beethoven symphonies so that people can experience that even if they didn't happen to be near an orchestra hall. In the case of bordellos, well, those 10 fingers and those little uprights down in places like New Orleans, they just offered a world of music and entertainment, and it couldn't have been easier for a musician to really make a hit with special techniques that each individual artist developed.
I really like the story, which you tell us in your book, A Natural History of the Piano, about how it all comes about. Tell us about Bartolomeo Cristofori and Ferdinando de' Medici.
Well, Ferdinando de' Medici had a huge collection of keyboards, mostly harpsichords. And he also had a love of gadgets and, as I say in the book, a roving eye. So he took off for Venice for this great festival, really a Bacchanalian festival, and enjoyed himself thoroughly. On the way back, passed through Padua and learned of a technician named Bartolomeo Cristofori. And he was in need of a technician. He had lost his technician. And so he asked Cristofori to accompany him back to Florence. And Cristofori said, well, I really would rather not. And apparently Ferdinando made him an offer that he couldn't refuse and brought him back. For a while, Cristofori was just repairing instruments. But then he started to tinker and create his own, and lo and behold, he came up with this radical idea of an instrument. He called it a cypress keyboard with soft and loud. And unlike the harpsichord, which really cannot vary in dynamics simply by the touch of the player, because the notes occur through quills plucking strings and the volume stays the same, Cristofori's invention allowed people to create dynamic expressiveness simply by how softly or loudly they were striking the keys.
So it So it becomes a piano and forte, and later shortened to the piano, of course. And before that, as you just said, people were listening to the harpsichord. I just want to play a little bit of Johann Sebastian Bach's Fugue in F-sharp minor, written in 1722 and played on the harpsichord here by Glenn Gould in this 1970 recording. So these two are very different. What's behind it? What are we hearing that makes the harpsichord so foreign to the piano?
It's built on this idea that one can, it's connected sort of to the lute, the idea that one can pluck a string. And so harpsichord builders would create a mechanism that allowed a string to be plucked by a quill as a note on the keyboard was depressed. And it has a kind of a nasally sound, and it has an unwavering dynamic level. And because of that, there's a limit to how expressive the music can be in the hands of a player. The piano, on the other hand, can get louder, softer, it can swell slowly like most instruments do. And that just makes a world of difference. It has hammers that strike the strings as opposed to plucking them, and that's one of the big differences.
Yes, I was going to get to the hammers. And some of them, they were called little batons with cotton batting around them or some type of material.
Sometimes parchment. But as the piano evolved, the hammers evolved as well. Today we have felt hammers, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And creates a soft, warm, beautiful sound.
And no one could do that with that many strings from the keyboard prior to Cristofori's invention.
No, I mean, organs had the ability to swell, but they tended to be overwhelming in their sound. And the clavichord was also capable of nuanced expression. This is a sort of a tabletop keyboard with metal tangents that strike the strings. It was quite lovely. However, the sound was so soft it could not be used for performance. Mozart had one in his bedroom because he loved it so much.
Well, we're going to come to Mozart in just a little bit. We're talking about the birth, the life of the piano, how it shaped the sounds of our history. You can join the conversation with Stuart Isikoff. How do you remember piano? Can you still feel the weight of the keys beneath your fingers? We'll go out with one of the earliest pieces ever to be written for the piano. The first movement of Ludovico Giustini's Sonata No. 3 in F, played here on an early pianoforte by Andrea Cohen. I'm Jackie Lydon. I'm sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking here today about the magic of the piano, the music, the musicians. Please join the conversation. Who are you listening to sitting at the bench? What piece grabs you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest today is pianist and composer Stuart Isikoff. He's professor of music at Purchase College at New York State University, and he's the author of the new book, A Natural History of the Piano. Stuart, as you well know, we've just heard the first movement of C.P.E. Bach, one of Bach's sons, the third sonata in G minor, played here by Mikhail Plent, a bit of a blustery number. But as you write, the first piano superstar, and I think it's interesting to think of who brought it to our ears, was really Mozart, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, a prodigy from early youth, right?
Yes, and he is named in my book as the first piano superstar. The piano had been around since around 1700, when Cristofori invented it, but it wasn't paid attention to all that much. There were pianos scattered here and there. In fact, Mozart never saw one in his childhood. He came across one in the 1770s in Munich, instantly went crazy about it. And it was Mozart in the 1780s in Vienna who really brought it to the public attention through his writing of piano concertos, which he unveiled at subscription concerts all throughout Vienna in restaurants and clubs and halls. So at that time, the audiences were, around 150 or so, to hear these magnificent works. Today we go to a concert hall and there are thousands of people on hand, but for Mozart, this was just the very beginning of showing off what the instrument could actually do.
I just love that story that he bypasses the court. He plays for Marie Antoinette as a teenager. He's so young. He has to beg his father to buy him the piano when he's very young, and then decides to do, as you just said, these subscription concerts. Can you just imagine being invited over to Mozart's house to hear something like this? Here is the 20th Piano Concerto. He's at the keyboard himself in 1785, not obviously in this piece. We'll listen to this recording with the conductor and pianist, Murray Pariah, with the English Symphony Orchestra. Mozart dies in 1791, Stuart. What is it about Mozart and this performance that really grabs you?
Mozart is one of those artists who encompass all that came before him. That C.P.E. Bach piece, for example, is a very early example of a kind of writing that's incredibly turbulent, which is capable on the piano because of the dynamic range. But he also was influenced by another Bach son, Johann Christian Bach, also known as the London Bach, who had studied in Italy and was simple and lyrical in his writing. Mozart takes a little of this, a little of that, the lessons of Haydn, and the lessons of J.S. Bach as well, eventually. And he combines them in this really lovely, emotion-filled, technically perfect way. In fact, in the 19th century, people would say things like the fact that Beethoven, in his struggles, and you see struggle in every moment of Beethoven's music, in his struggles, he eventually reaches heaven. And on the other hand, Mozart, of course, just comes from heaven. Mozart, the lyricism, the fact that his concertos actually are all like little operas without words. There's just something wondrous about what he's able to accomplish.
Now, this is only about 85 years after the invention of the piano as we know it today. What other composers, other than Mozart, were writing for it?
At that time, well, you had Clementi, Muzio Clementi, an Italian who moved to England. And he actually had a piano competition, an improvisation competition with Mozart. Neither man realized they were about to face each other, but Joseph II invited them individually and then posed this competition on the spot, they had to try to outdo each other. Mozart was very unhappy because the keys of his instrument kept sticking, and Joseph said, "Never mind, just keep going." And in the end, he said that Clementi was just a robot. Clementi was much kinder to Mozart. The two of them sort of vied for the position of piano superstar for a while.
Don't you write that today poor Clementi is mainly known for practicing scales, while, of course, Mozart fills Lincoln Center every summer with the mostly Mozart performances.
Yes. Eventually, later on in his older years, Clementi admitted that at the time he had come up against Mozart, that he had a lot to learn about musical depth.
Now, in your book, you've taken on dividing pianists and composers into four big categories. Could you talk about that a little bit and how you define them and who falls into each one?
Yes. I have always been irked by the idea that classical music is treated as something separate from jazz, that there are these huge walls erected between different genres. And I've even been unhappy with the general chronological labels that people place on classical music, that is, Baroque, classical, romantic, and so on, because I think they miss a lot of the subtle differences and individuality that one encounters in each of those periods. And so I was looking for a unified theory of piano style, if you will. And I began by looking at the sound of the instrument itself and realized that there are different components to that sound when you strike a key and the music begins to emerge from the instrument. And if I isolate those different components of sound, I can trace each of them to an approach to the piano that one finds in every genre and in every period. And so I began with the idea that when the hammer hits the string, you get a little percussive pop. When that percussive pop is presented center stage, you get the kind of music that I label the rhythmatizers. And then you have this soaring melodic tone that emerges. And if that is the predominant quality of a piece of music, then that falls into a category I call the melodists. If you listen to the sound of the piano after you've struck a chord, there's a kind of a wavering that happens. And it occurs because there's a kind of harmonic mixture happening in the strings. There's a slight out-of-tuneness that causes what technicians call beating. And that wavering leads me to think about harmonic chemistry. And I apply the term alchemists to people who are concerned with that harmonic chemistry. And then finally, you have the wide dynamic range of the softest soft and the loudest loud. And people who make use of that range, I call the combustibles, because they tend to write music where this range can simmer, make the music simmer and explode. And they usually represent great turbulence.
Well, let's take the last first and hear a little bit from the category you call combustible. Here's one of the greats, Ludwig van Beethoven, and the first movement of his masterful Waldstein piano sonata in C major, which he wrote in the summer of 1804 for Count von Waldstein of Vienna. This recording features Dubravka Tomaszczyk on the piano. Talk about why you call Ludwig van Beethoven combustible. You've written that he could be emotionally eruptive, but also that he had a great strength as he played. And, of course, you talked earlier about the whole combustible notion of hitting these keys.
Yes, and this stems from the C.P.E. Bach that we heard earlier, this idea of loud and soft and fast and slow and it's a rapid shift of emotional state. And in C.P. Bach's time, that was connected with a literary movement known as Storm and Stress. Goethe's Sorrows of Young Werther was a part of that movement. And there were paintings that that emphasized the grotesque. This is all part of a movement that prized this idea of emotional disruptions. And Beethoven is certainly filled with that in his music. Some of the critics of his time talked about how doves and crocodiles cohabitated in his work. And he was also capable of rendering a piano into a pile of splinters. There were reports of Beethoven playing and having people reach their arms into the keyboard to remove broken wires while he was playing.
That's another great story. Let's play a more modern combustible and see what you think of it. Here's the singer-songwriter Ben Folds on his song One Angry Dwarf and 200 Solemn Faces, performed live on his 2002 tour.
¶¶
So exciting. That was Ben Folds, pianist, singer, songwriter. Stuart Isikoff, what do you make of this? It's not Beethoven, but you call it combustible.
Well, it follows the same tradition of this idea of being explosive and really taking advantage of the softness and the loudness that the instrument can provide. Other examples include Jerry Lee Lewis, Cecil Taylor, contemporary jazz pianist, and Liszt, who would have three pianos on stage at a time because he would break one and move on to the next.
You know, I really dwelled a little bit on the Franz Liszt part because he was called the modern Orpheus at the time, who could play
yes.
storms. And just the way that these people transfixed their listeners was just incredible.
Liszt was clearly the Mick Jagger of his time. I mean, ladies went crazy. They flung their jewelry at him on stage. And he would milk it for all it was worth. He would slowly remove his gloves and throw them on the floor, and then all of these audience members would rush, mostly female, of course, would rush to rip little pieces of the gloves to take a souvenir home with them.
We're speaking with Stuart Isikoff, the author of A Natural History of the Piano, the Instrument, the Music, the Musicians from Mozart to Modern Jazz and everything in between. And we're taking your calls. Let's go to Elliot, who is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, Elliot.
Hi, Jackie. I'd like to ask your guest about the evolution of the acoustic piano. It feels like it's sort of stuck in the late 19th century, early 20th century, the large Steinways and Bösendorfers, and hasn't moved at all into new materials. And then also I'd like to ask a totally separate, disparate question, which is if your guest could also comment on the impact of Bill Evans in both jazz and classical.
Okay, that's a twofer. But Stuart?
Well, I think the caller is quite right, that the piano sort of stopped developing at a certain point. We have the iron frame so that a Liszt or a Beethoven can no longer just smash the instrument to pieces. And there are all kinds of other developments and improvements. I think Steinway has something like 150 patents. However, the instrument did reach a certain point and then stop. There are little tinkerings that happen today, and there are cute devices. Peter Serkin, for example, puts a lid underneath the piano rather than above it because he thinks it projects the sound better to the audience. There are developments in the use of materials that change the piano somewhat, but essentially we have that basic design, and the innovations today are all along the lines of electronic instruments.
What about
Bill? And Bill, I have to say, Bill Evans, we're going to get to, aren't we, Jackie?
Yes, because as you have discussed, you do not want anything here to be overly mired in the past, that this is modern music for us as well. But you do bring up this other group called the Rhythmatizers. And
yes.
Just give us that definition again quickly.
Well, those are people who take that little percussive pop that we hear at the beginning when the hammer strikes the string and create music in which the percussive rhythmic element is the predominant element. Of course, you always have rhythm and melody and harmony. They're always present in everything, but there tend to be maybe one or two of these that become predominant in any particular work.
All right, so hold on to that because we want you to call in and discuss your rhythmatizers, your alchemists, your combustibles. Join the conversation. What do you hear in the piano's past, your top composers? Here, as Stuart Isikoff calls it, is a true rhythmatizer, Dave Brubeck and his quartet with Blue Rondo a la Turk off of his 1959 album, Time Out. I'm Jackie Lydon, and I'm in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're listening to the piano. From the notes on the page to the punch of fingertips, you can join the conversation. What matters most to you in piano's biggest composers? What's that special sound that keeps us writing for it, listening to it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me is Stuart Isikoff, pianist, composer, and author. His new book is called A Natural History of the Piano. And we're listening to Thelonious Monk playing what he calls his unidentified piano solo, which he recorded in 1958 in New York City. And you actually call him an alchemist, Stuart.
I do, yes. I took the term alchemist from Claude Debussy. When he, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, when he was writing his remarkable works for piano, the people at the Paris Conservatory complained that he was much too odd. And Debussy's reply was, "I'm not interested in the science of the beaver," by which he meant nature's little engineers that put things together in proper order. He said, "Rather, I'm interested in the alchemy of sound." And so this idea of harmonic chemistry that can occur is something that I call alchemy. And it tends to be music that is atmospheric and that seems to transport us to another world.
Well, will you let me transport you to another world for just a moment here? Because the conventions of the show are such that I want to add another rhythmatizer. And this is the great legendary jazz pianist Fats Waller, who really captured America with his tune, A Handful of Keys. And in the song, you can hear Fats Waller's sharp percussive hits on the piano's keyboard driving the song forward. Fats to the rhythmatizers, Stuart?
Fats, are you asking about Fats' place in the pantheon?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Fats was a part of the Harlem Stride piano school, along with his friends James P. Johnson and Willie the Lion Smith. And they were also, by the way, very close with George Gershwin. And they impressed everyone who came by. There were challenges in the jazz world, of course, just as there were in the classical world. And these three men just put fear into the hearts of every pianist who attempted to get out there and play for an audience. The only one who sort of intimidated them was Art Tatum, who showed up from Toledo one day and wiped the floor with all of them. But they were the people who established this style, this stride style of playing, so-called because the left hand ranges back and forth between the very bottom of the keyboard and the middle of the keyboard, highly rhythmic style, and very difficult to pull off. If anybody, any of you listeners have ever tried it, they know how difficult it is.
Well, let's speak to a listener. Sam is calling from Everett, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, Sam.
Hey, great program. I'm glad that Art Tatum's name came up. My uncle was a concert pianist, classical concert pianist, and he told me that when he was at Juilliard, everybody at Juilliard who was studying the piano would go out and hear Art Tatum play because they knew that he was the man. He was better than Rubinstein. He was better than anybody. And when they went to go see him, they just said that he was in a category of one. And I love him as well, and I'd say he's one of those pianists who's just in a category of one. There's nobody else there with him.
Are you going to give us your uncle's name?
I'd rather not. But he assured me that everybody at Juilliard, they all went late hours, you know, after they went from Carnegie Hall and Town Hall, they'd go down to the clubs and they'd go hear him, and he was the one that they looked to say that this guy was just a genius.
Well, thanks for sharing that story, Sam. Let's return to the alchemists, which is the category that we began with here when you were speaking of Thelonious Monk. First of all, why do you call him an alchemist?
Well, he creates a very strange world. His harmonies are unusual. His use of silence is startling sometimes. To me, it's a portal into some strange universe that only he created. So I've put him there. I think that alchemy can be accomplished musically in any number of ways, partly through this kind of musical perfume that people like Debussy created, but also in other ways, just ways that take us to a different world. And Monk was certainly one of those.
Well, perfume is a wonderful word if you're thinking of alchemy. And really, I think that the sensibility of each of these are rather like different scents. And you talked about how the different arts synergized each other earlier. Let's hear a little more from the French composer and pianist Claude Debussy, who wrote this piece, his piano prelude number 4. As he called it, the sounds and fragrances swirl through the evening air. That's the English translation from the French. This was written between 1909 and 1910. And here it is, played by soloist Christian Zimmermann. Stuart, Debussy was famous for mixing sound with expression and combining the senses. You're hearing that in this recording?
I think so. He was very involved in a movement around the turn of the century in Paris, and there was a similar movement in Russia, in which, as Baudelaire put it, colors, fragrances, sound all mingle together. And in a kind of just a sensual immersion. And this music reflects that kind of a sensibility, I think.
You want to try the title in French?
Oh, let's see. Les sons et les parfums tournent dans l'air du soir. That's my best shot.
That's a pretty good one, I think. Gorgeous. Let's take another call. David is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, David.
Thank you. Hi, Jackie and Stuart. Stuart, I wonder if you'd comment on the pleasures of playing the piano. I'm 69 years old. I've been playing light classical and popular music all my life, and I'm astonished to realize that I keep on getting better, both technically and expressively. And I play in nursing homes and hospitals, and I'm able to give an enormous amount of pleasure to other people.
Well, I applaud you for that. That is just fabulous. You know, there was a time when every home had a piano and every child had piano lessons. And I think that it's sad that it doesn't seem to be the case any longer. There is so much pleasure to be gained from playing. And it really doesn't matter whether you ever get to be on the level of a concert pianist. There's this pleasure to be had, there's music to be made, and there's joy to be brought to other people, and I just applaud you for doing that.
Stuart, I'd like to turn to another grouping, the Melodists, and talk about who they were. And let's start off with the Polish composer and virtuoso pianist, Frédéric Chopin. His second movement from his 8th Nocturne in D-flat major, played in this recording by the legendary Arthur Rubinstein. Now, Chopin lived from 1810 to 1849. In your book, you tell of his unique style and melodies. What is it about his music that set him apart from contemporaries like Robert Schumann and Felix Mendelssohn?
Partly he brought with him certain things he had learned in his native Poland. He left Warsaw in 1830, as so many artists did at the time because of fighting going on there. And so he incorporated some of that Polish dance rhythm that we hear in his pieces like mazurkas and polonaises. But he also came with somehow just a singular voice that no one else matched. It's clearly romantic. It's sometimes close to that of his friend Franz Liszt. But there's just something so soulful, melancholy, and gorgeous about it. And part of it might have been his own fragility. I mean, he was sick his entire life and had just a huge heart, I guess. It all comes out in the music.
Let's take another call. John is calling from Burlington, Vermont. Welcome to On Point, John.
Oh, thank you. I'm really enjoying this conversation. I'm actually an oral piano tuner, and love what you're talking about. A way I often describe the piano's function to clients is by describing the piano action as a miniature catapult. And it really is a very accurate description of how all the moving parts interact, in that you shoot the hammer at the string and reload it.
You shoot the hammer, and like a catapult, it reloads?
That's correct. So a grand piano is a miniature automatic catapult, and an upright is just a miniature catapult. And I also wanted to know if Stuart has ever encountered a Mason and Hamlin screw stringer.
Stuart, have you ever encountered a Mason and Hamlin screw stringer?
I think one night when I got drunk at a bar.
I was about to say the same thing.
I can't say.
Oh, thank you. Let's try to take one more call here. Greg is calling from East Lansing, Michigan. Welcome to On Point, Greg.
Hi, Jackie. I was a program manager for a concert pianist about 30, 35 years ago. And we toured the country, I think, of about 100 cities, mostly high schools and some universities. And at one point, we had the opportunity to go through the Baldwin Piano Factory. I think that was in Kentucky. And they sat him down in these sound rooms. He played 3 10-foot Baldwin grand pianos, all brand new. And none of them sounded identical. Now, I'm not a musician. So we were driving to the next concert the next day. And I said, I don't understand. I didn't hear the same sound from these pianos. And I had listened to his concerts for hundreds of times. And he said, of course, no piano is identical. And they all have a different sound to them. And my question is, at that time, he said, you know, Greg, the finest pianos in the world are made here in the U.S., by Steinway and Baldwin. And my question to you is, is that still true today?
Thank you. Stuart?
Well, Baldwin underwent some difficulties and stopped manufacturing pianos at a certain point. I'm not sure whether that name has been resurrected or not. Steinway makes an incredibly fine piano, but there are other manufacturers around the world who also make very fine pianos. And it's true that any handmade piano, you know, it's a different case when something is just made in a mass assembly line. But any handmade piano is going to have its own personality. It's absolutely true. Not only that, but any single piano is going to sound different in the hands of different pianists. So as Menachem Pressler, the wonderful pianist, said in the book, it's really a living thing. It's a remarkable thing to think about, because it's, after all, it's a mechanical object, and yet somehow it has the qualities of a living being.
Stuart, do you have a favorite amongst your categories?
I don't think I do have a favorite. No, I'm an omnivore. I just love so many different musicians and so many different kinds of music. I tend in my own playing, I play both classical and jazz, and in my own improvisations, I have to say that I probably tend more toward the alchemists.
Will the the alchemists. And now we know what they are. Do you think the piano will be around forever?
I do, and you could call me naive because the world changes and things come and go. But I do think the piano is irreplaceable. I just can't imagine that anything else could take its place, certainly not in my heart. So as long as I'm around, I will have one.
So the monk aficionado in you will be continuing your alchemy, but this will continue to change the way we create music. It will still be an instrument of innovation, won't it?
Yes, and there may be changes to the piano that we know today. There are all kinds of possibilities. I mean, after all, there are pianos now with electronic capability built in, reproducing pianos that use the actual acoustic action to replicate sounds.
Stuart, it has been such a great pleasure speaking with you.
Well, thank you, Jackie. It's great. It's great for me. Thanks for having me.
Stuart Isikoff. He's the author of A Natural History of the Piano, The Instrument, The Music, and we'll go out with George Gershwin playing the second movement in C-sharp minor from his piece Three Preludes. I'm Jackie Leiden for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.